This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. After 3 years, Charlotte City Manager Ron Carley is out with little explanation. What happened? CMS firms up its goals for its student reassignment effort, even as the mayor of Matthews calls for splitting from the district. Increased enrollment at charter schools is beating that at CMS 5-1. And Democrats head to the polls in South Carolina, an election that may decide the fate of Bernie Sanders. Those and other stories will be the focus of our weekly local news roundup this hour. WFAE's Tom Bullock is here, along with Mary Newsom, Associate Director of the UNC Charlotte Urban Institute and the person in charge of PlanCharlotte.org. We're also joined by Eric with a C, Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer, and Eric with a K, Spanberg. Is it K in Spanberg? Senior writer for the Charlotte Tricky. Business Journal. Thank you all for being here. Good morning and welcome back. If you would like to send us your thoughts throughout the program, you can do that on Facebook or on Twitter at Charlotte Talks, or email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Anthony Fox, we all remember him.
Yes.
He was mayor of Charlotte when he and city council hired Ron Carley to be the city manager. He was the first outsider, Ron Carley was, in years to get that job. And Fox specifically said, I want him to be the face of the city. I want him to be our spokesperson. And he hit the ground running on that. He was on the show a couple of times. And now Mayor Jennifer Roberts and City Council have decided not to renew his 3-year contract when it expires in March. Was this a surprise?
No, not after what happened last year.
What happened last year?
Remember, the city council had several meetings to discuss whether they, in fact, liked their city manager, and also deferred a decision on contract negotiations or whether to even extend his contract. So that was the first sign that he probably was facing trouble. And all along, there has been a lot of resentment among some on council about what you just outlined, which is that council members felt that Anthony Fox picked Carley because of his support of the streetcar. Ron Carley had been in Arlington, Virginia, and he was a fan of streetcars. And as you may remember, Mike, we have spent some fair amount of time in our humble burg debating the merits of spending money on a streetcar. So right from the beginning, he had several people who were not happy with him.
And I think part of his what ended up being his problem was that he was a pick from Anthony Fox. And there were some on council who didn't get along with Fox, who resented Fox. And some on council who just were kind of neutral, they liked the streetcar, but they didn't like this guy being told, you're the face of the city, when if you're a politician, you want to be the face of the city.
Well, the interesting thing, though, is if you go back and look at the vote in 2013 when they actually, you know, the council voted to hire Ron Carley as city manager, all but one voted to bring him in. All but one decided, okay, let's give this a shot. I mean, and ironically, the one who didn't was Patrick Cannon. And the reason I bring that up is because, you know, Carley has definitely been a divisive figure for some. My first experience with Charlotte city government when I came here 2 years ago was, you know, dueling press conferences about a winter storm between Patrick Cannon and Ron Carley. And I'll tell you what, everybody knew where which of those two was the most important press conference to cover, and that was Ron Carley. We have, as you know, people well know here, we have a weak mayor system. They're elected, but really it's you know, guiding policy and, you know, cheerleading for the city. Ron Carley, you know, has been the guy for the last 3 years who has run this city day-to-day operations.
Well, but let's remember, it's always been the city manager who runs the city.
Yes.
What's going on here is we have a war of ego because the traditional city manager in Charlotte, Wendell White and Pam Seifert and Kurt Walton, is they were running things, but they would stay in the background and you sort of didn't really watch the puppeteer. And when Ron Carley came in, you know, from a media standpoint, Ron Carley was great because you finally got a sense of what people in the government center were doing and thinking and what they were planning. And it drove council nuts because they wanted to be out front.
He was an outside. I'm sorry, go ahead, Eric.
It does leave, you know, the question of what does the council actually want going forward? I mean, do they want another Kurt Walton, a guy who, you know, would sooner light himself on fire than talk to a reporter? Or do they want someone who will be or try to at least walk this, you know, sort of tricky, you know, tightrope act of, you know, being the center of power within City Hall, but not
That's why Kurt had to step away. He was so singed that he had to just step
away. I think part of what you have to keep in mind is that this job is more than just a political job. You're also a manager and an administrator.
Yeah.
And if you're brought in to be a change agent, that automatically puts people on edge if they are the ones who are to be changed.
Did he ruffle feathers behind the scenes?
Yes, absolutely.
Yes.
With people who may have the ear of city council?
Yes, and actually with city council as well. I mean, the most high-profile change – and there were reports of – I mean, a lot of high-level city staff members left while Carly was city manager. And there were always these kind of grumblings that it was because they didn't like his approach or they didn't agree with him. I mean, he was launching audits of city departments. He was he came from his prior job with a whole list of what he saw as best practices and a real push for transparency. Now, that's great for journalists. But if you're a city staffer, when somebody is asking these kinds of questions, it can really rub you the wrong way.
His previous two jobs were a former manager of the D.C. suburb of Arlington County, which is a big county, a lot of people, and a lot of complications, and the streetcar, which is still being built up there, I think, and COO of the International City Council Management Association.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't hire a guy like that.
Rolls off the tongue, doesn't it?
You don't hire a guy like that and not expect to get, sort of a big footprint from him, with ideas and trying to force his vision
on
the
city. And he was asked to be the spokesperson for the city, and last year he did begin to step back into the shadows, I think, either for his own political survival or because he was told to, correct?
And I think it's a combination of the two. But let's remember, again, Anthony Fox was really driving the hiring decision. And so what Ron Carley heard was, you're going to be out front, you're going to be the spokesman, and all of a sudden there's some guy in D.C. that calls Anthony Fox, offers him a little better job, and so his biggest ally, Ron Carley's biggest ally, is gone. And so the other thing that I would feel like we would all be remiss and sad if we didn't mention, of course, is that Ron Carley was also prominent in the airport fight.
Yep.
And so that also ruffled feathers with people at the airport who were loyal to Jerry Orr, the former aviation director. And you want to talk about audits, man. It's like audit-palooza out there.
So let's remind people about that. And for people who may have moved here after that occurred, the legislature wanted to take over essentially the airport, which the city has run since the very beginning, by appointing an airport commission. The airport commission was sided with by the former airport director, Jerry Orr.
Who worked for the city.
So Carley, Jerry Orr alleges, Carley fired him, while Carley says Orr fired himself by working with the legislatively appointed airport committee. That situation is still unresolved.
Correct. And here, if we can just tie a nice bow on it, Anthony Fox, our former mayor, of course, is the transportation secretary, which oversees.
Which is why probably it's not resolved.
Exactly. Which oversees the FAA, and the FAA has said, we are thinking about this, but we just don't know when we can get back to you. So that's.
Wasn't the last thing that the FAA said they wouldn't act until the city asked them to do something? And of course, the city's not going to ask.
Yeah, the city seems to be in favor of keeping the airport, it looks like.
But could it be said that the way he handled the airport situation helped save the airport for the city?
Oh, absolutely.
Sure. Oh, I think he gets good marks for how he handled the airport situation and how he handled the Patrick Cannon arrest situation as well.
And that is really a big thing. I mean, the way that he kept the city going, he kept everything relatively calm. I mean, when you have your sitting mayor let out of his office in handcuffs,
that's a bad day at work.
It's a bad day at work.
I believe Carley did utter an expletive when he saw that.
It was reported.
It was something like shucks.
Yes. But Ron Carley, there are his detractors, but there are also his defenders, and he really has done a lot to keep the city going. I mean, another thing besides the Patrick Cannon fiasco is last year's city budget. I mean, the city of Charlotte was looking at the biggest deficit because of a combination of factors. And Carley really helped come up with a budget that minimized, in many people's view, the amount of – I mean, there was a property tax hike, but it could have been significantly bigger. And actually, it's one of the more problematic things about when his contract expires, because we are in budget season.
There are already whispers that he will stick around at least long enough to keep the budget process going. Tom brings up an interesting point. So property taxes have gone up in two of the last 3 years, as any Charlotte homeowner could tell you. But for politicians, of course, they hate whenever taxes go up. And I do think that Carly, in a lot of ways, is the fall guy for a tax situation that largely out of his control. So there's that factor, too. But when you go through all these things, I mean, I think his track record is actually pretty good in a lot of areas.
Yeah, I'm a fan of his. I mean, not to say that he hasn't, you know, had missteps.
The whistleblower case, for sure.
Yeah, the fire department thing was a big, was a big mess up. But
and
we haven't mentioned
Rodney Monroe. I mean, and that's another thing that does need to be brought up here is when former CMPD chief Rodney Monroe decided last year it was time to retire, a lot of members on council said or thought that maybe it was Carly's fault because of his, you know, audits and his what can be seen as brash behind the scenes leadership style. Yeah. And that is something that has continued to haunt Carly.
Yeah, I think if you're Rodney Monroe and you're brought here as kind of a star in the world of policing and you find yourself working for a city manager who wants to micromanage you, which apparently Carly did with a lot of people, that's going to rub you the wrong way. And the audits and the why are you doing it this way? And apparently a certain lack of a warm, fuzzy personality is just going to exacerbate anything you try to do.
So one of our listeners, Jason, writes in, no accounting of Mr. Carly's tenure would be complete without recognizing the decision he and his staff made in response to a years-long campaign by many groups and individuals, including the Center for Community Transitions, Charlotte School of Law, Civil Rights Clinic, and Councilperson Lawana Mayfield, to ban the box from almost all municipal job applications. Mr. Carly acted when many on City Council failed to. His change to Charlotte's hiring practices will assure individuals who have passed criminal convictions a fair shake at employment while assuring workplace safety. Thank you, Mr. Carly. This ban the box thing is where you had to check off if you'd ever been,
convicted of a felony.
Right.
Yeah.
Which kept a lot of people. That was the end of the interview because you wouldn't be hired. So the observers, all the news organizations reported that Mayor Roberts convened this five council committee to consider a contract renewal. Was that because it was time? Was time?
Yes. Well, March 31st.
She didn't have it out for him, did she?
Well, no. But as Eric with a K brought up, they were supposed to decide this last year, and it was still controversial enough that they kicked the can down the road until the new council was set.
So the Observer reported, or maybe you reported, Tom, that when they got together to consider this renewal, they were split. Well, this is a five-member committee, so which way did the split go?
I think that must be the new math.
Who was on the new committee?
Well,
who's on this committee?
This was not my reporting, to be fair. That was actually by Steve Harrison of The Observer.
Yeah. And I think you mentioned Mayor Roberts. I think her kind of – I'm not sure what her exact position on Carly was, but her position – just generally speaking on this, having come from where she came from with, you know, the late unpleasantness with, the county commission, I think she probably was kind of walking on eggshells through this, just trying not to be, you know, seen
what's
as
past
the
prologue.
Trying not to be seen as the weak person. Let me just toss in
that there's some irony here because one of the criticisms of Jennifer Roberts on the county commission was that she did not fire Harry Jones, the then county manager.
So now
she's on
proactive.
Now in the city government, the city manager is gone.
Yeah. So I have 30 seconds left. The Observer reported it this way, that Mr. Carly would step down at the end of his contract in March and that he would not seek an extension of his contract. That's a way of positioning it, I suppose. So what is it? Was he fired? Was he?
I imagine it was one of these deals where there's an agreement that, you know, neither party, neither side really wants to go
forward. An amicable divorce.
Yeah, yes. Amicably.
As Michael Barnes put it to me, he didn't want to wait for the no confidence vote.
Previous city council.
Stop right there.
He was the first one with a contract.
Oh, you must stop because we must stop. We have to take a break. We're coming back with more Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Ballet's Little Mermaid, featuring the underwater world created by Hans Christian Andersen and brought to life by new sets and costumes March 11th through 20th at Knight Theater. Tickets and information at charlotteballet.org. And Novant Health Cancer Care, providing customized treatment plans and a team of doctors, nurses, and specialists to help give patients the support they need. Information available at novanthealth.org/cancer. cancer. We're going to start Monday on this program with a look at the voters' decision in Saturday's South Carolina Democratic primary and the impact that decision may have on the race between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders going forward. And then March Madness is on the horizon. We'll have a conversation with sports columnist John Feinstein, whose latest book looks back on a golden age of North Carolina college basketball, that of Jim Valvano, Dean Smith, and Mike Krzyzewski. That's all Monday on this program at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, establishment Republicans grapple with how to stop Donald Trump. A political battle over the Supreme Court vacancy escalates, and the Senate reaches a bipartisan funding deal on the Flint water crisis.
The News Roundup continues from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on the Diane Rehm Show. Here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's our local weekly news roundup with Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Mary Newsom from the UNC Charlotte Urban Institute, Eric Frazier, Eric with a C from the Charlotte Observer, Eric Spanberg with a K from the Charlotte Business Journal, and Liza with a Z. Somewhere is here, I'm sure. I interrupted you, Mary, going into the break, and you wanted to make a point.
The point I was trying to make was that Ron Carley has a contract. Previous city managers did not have a contract. They were at-will employees.
So who – I'm sorry.
I predict the next one will be an at-will employee.
That was my next question. Who will be next? Who will they turn to next? What will they be looking for? Another outsider? Will they turn to somebody on the inside?
Well, I would say that, you know, I think in their heart of hearts they would love to have an insider, but that there's really no one left. Now, the one thing I heard floated this week is that maybe they could get Deputy City Manager Ron Kimball to do it on an interim basis. But Kimball has been talking about retiring for the past couple of years. He and his wife have a foundation, and he wants to work on that. So I suspect that the final choice will be someone from the outside.
And the interesting thing here is timing. You know, this is – and it calls into question exactly what the real motivation behind this was, if it was indeed an amicable divorce, whatever the case may be. But the timing is really problematic. Normally with a situation like this, with a major metropolitan area, you're going to have a clear timeline. Or someone like in college basketball, let's say your head coach goes, you say, well, that's okay. The interim coach is going to be X. They haven't – not only have they not named anybody, as Eric just pointed out, they don't even have a timeline yet for when that search is going to begin.
Well, maybe they need to consult with the school board about how not to handle this situation.
On March 8th, we could have everybody figure out when they're hiring someone.
So yeah. This brings up an – I don't know whether this has any weight or not, but this brings up an interesting question about our psyche here, our zeitgeist here. We bring in this bright and shining star who is highly accomplished and has a track record and a resume to beat the band, Ron Carley. We do the same thing with Heath Morrison at the school department. They come in here as outsiders, they ruffle feathers, and we get rid of them.
Well, I do think there is a little bit of Mayberry at work here. Now, clearly Carley has made some mistakes, and he lost his biggest ally, as I mentioned before. But I also think that this is part of that transition from, you know, a small town into a larger city. And a lot of the audits and things that he was doing, I could certainly understand if you're working over at the government center, hey, we've never done this before. Why are we doing this now? But I think what Ron Carley was saying is, look, in bigger places, such as suburban Washington, this is the way business is done, and this is the way we're going to have to do business because we're growing at such a rapid rate.
Well, if you like it so much up there, why don't you go back?
Well, I think that's the offer that was extended to him.
and 3 years is very typical for administrator.
True. But not here, and that's why it's been so jarring to people is because, you know, you had the Wendell White, Pam Seifert, Kurt Walton. Even though Kurt was only 5 years, he had been in city government for years and years. And so this is a big shift for us. But, yeah, it's basically like a college football coach, 3 years and see ya.
All right, let's all put our faces to the sun. Let's turn south to South Carolina, the primary there tomorrow, the Democratic primary. Unlike the Republican primary, these two candidates haven't spent a lot of time in the state, although Hillary was everywhere, evidently, yesterday. Bernie Sanders is spending a lot of time elsewhere because I think he knows he's not going to do well in this. But is that why? Because the outcome is really relatively certain on this?
Well, let's be clear about a couple points. Both candidates have absolutely been in South Carolina quite a lot. I mean, I can point to one instance on Martin Luther King Jr. Day. I was down in Columbia for the annual march, and Bernie Sanders led that march along with Martin O'Malley, if everybody remembers him. And Hillary Clinton joined the three of them.
Check my program. Okay, got it.
Hillary Clinton joined those two men to give speeches when they reached the Capitol. But the reason Hillary has been everywhere, Bernie Sanders was in Super Tuesday states. Right. He'll be back in the state today. But it's a combination of things. Number one, right now I hate prognosticating too much, but right now South Carolina is Hillary country unless Bernie Sanders' campaign has pulled off a major surprise. She was leading in Real Clear Politics poll of South Carolina polls by 24 points. It's a massive margin, and it's been steady. So the Sanders campaign has to look forward to Super Tuesday, which is going to happen 72 hours after South Carolina. To them, it makes more sense to try to focus on states where you have a smaller gap.
Evangelical voters were very important in the outcome of the Republican primary last Saturday. What about the role of African-American voters in South Carolina in the Democratic primary? As important, less important, more important?
As important, perhaps even more so. I mean, you're talking about pretty much half of the Democratic primary electorate in South Carolina. So, and I think the biggest piece of Bernie's problem in South Carolina, and probably in a lot of places where you have high African American votership, is that he just has not pierced that veil that Hillary has. You know, when it comes to her, you know, bear hugging of Obama and saying, I'm the rightful heir to the Obama legacy.
Well, if anybody saw the Charles Blow column in the New York Times this week, I thought it was really interesting talking about African-American voters in the South versus African-American voters in the North. And one of the things he was talking about is, remember, Hillary Clinton not only is hugging Obama's legacy right now, but she has a deep and long history in the South itself, not only as the First Lady of Arkansas, but she's been tied to Marion Wright Edelman, who is from South Carolina, for her entire career. So she really has a legitimate stump speech to go in and say, hey, look, I've been with you. I've fought for you. This is something not only that I believe in, but that I've acted on. And Bernie Sanders has spent his entire career in Vermont and Washington. And so it's a much harder case for him to make.
There's an interesting point, though. And I spent some time with phone banks for both campaigns, both the Hillary Clinton campaign and Bernie Sanders campaign in Rock Hill this week. And you can learn so much from watching how campaigns do something that a lot of us see is quite menial, which is the actual moment of contact with potential voters. The Clinton campaign was all about logistics. You know, when are you going to vote? How are you going to vote? Do we need to get you a ride? The Bernie Sanders campaign, when they should have been focused on logistics, was still doing exactly what Eric was talking about. They were still introducing issues to the electorate, specifically to the African-American electorate. Now, there are some issues, as well known as both Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton are with the African American community. There are ties that you're starting to see them back away from that exact history. Mm-hmm. Let's not forget that in 1994, President Bill Clinton was behind the crime bill, which helped accelerate this mass incarceration that now both candidates are campaigning against. And it was fascinating yesterday when President Clinton was in Rock Hill talking about the need for prison reform, talking about the fact that America has the highest rate of mass incarceration of any major country. Mm-hmm. Now, I have to get this point out. It's interesting that that's actually no longer true because the Seychelles Islands and East Africa have now topped America when it comes to per capita.
Nice fact. That's a clip and save.
Thank you. Yeah. However, it shows the power of the African American vote. And mm-hmm. a unifying issue for both Southern and Northern African American Democrats.
Yeah, and it shows how far further left the Democratic electorate has moved since the 1990s. I mean, that was his calling card, Bill Clinton's calling card in the 90s. I'm a new Democrat. I'm going to be tough on. Yeah.
We're not going to have a sister soldier moment during the Hillary Clinton campaign.
Oh, by no means. No, that would be. That got him elected. Right. That would get her disqualified.
Well, he was a blue dog Democrat, and they don't exist anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, he worked with Republicans and signed off on bills that weren't perfect in the
Imagine
eyes of liberal
that.
Democrats.
What a traitor. Hillary Clinton has been calling into question Sanders' proposals for tuition-free college for students, which I would think is particularly attractive to a lot of African Americans. It would be very attractive to me. And particularly, she's saying that they could harm historically black colleges and universities, which is an obvious play toward the black vote. Did Sanders respond to that criticism?
I think he's been responding to that point, not necessarily that specific criticism. He has been campaigning, both candidates have been campaigning at historically black colleges and universities quite a lot, in fact. And, You know, HBCUs are in a very difficult bind right now. Yeah.
They're surprising that no one's come to the CIAA this week. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Tom.
No, that's a. I hadn't thought of that.
Just
that's
as you're saying that, I'm just thinking, my gosh, that is a perfect place to go and make your case right on the border of South Carolina and all these historically black schools.
Yeah, missed opportunity there.
Yeah. At halftime? When would they do it?
Well, there are nothing but fan festivals and parties and things. I mean, you know.
You just walk down the
street. Find a spot, and, yeah.
Well, speaking of that, Bernie Sanders has accused some of the Republican candidates, particularly Donald Trump, of leading a racist effort to delegitimize the presidency of Barack Obama. And he pointed out that his father, Sanders' father, came from Poland, and no one had yet asked him to see his birth certificate. But is the birth certificate argument really racially based? Because Donald Trump's asking to see Ted Cruz's, isn't he?
Well, and Marco Rubio.
Yeah, but it's still the same strain, you know, ugly strain of kind of
you're not one
racial
of
and ethnic, you know, so, nationalism, you know, clannish, you know, behavior.
Both Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, as I understand it, have thrown their support to President Obama's proposal to close Guantanamo, but I don't believe they talked about the possibility of moving some of those prisoners to the naval brig in South Carolina.
Well, they don't
have
to.
How will that affect them?
They don't have to, because right now this is a Pentagon review to look at potential places where they could move those prisoners. And the bigger debate is really about whether or not, as Commander-in-Chief, President Barack Obama has the authority, since Congress has passed a law banning those prisoners from being moved to U.S. soil. And it's not just the U.S. military brig just outside of Charleston that's being considered. It's the Supermax facility in kind of southern Colorado. There, Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. There's all kinds. I think it's a dozen different potential sites.
Yeah, and the one in Charleston. If he's still there, I think he's still there. The dirty bomber guy. He's been held in down there for years. I think one of those guys, one of those bomber guys is down there.
So it is expected that Hillary Clinton has this primary in South Carolina tomorrow sewn up, unless something amazing happens. If that turns out to be the case, is this the beginning of the end
for Bernie Sanders? It really could be. It could be a slow march. I mean, he has plenty of money, and he has a huge network of small donors.
That's huge.
Yeah. that have given, I think the average is $27. Now, you know, there are limits on how much somebody can give, but that has a whole lot of headroom for them to keep going. He can make it likely to the convention, at least on cash. But this is the bigger narrative that he is facing. There are two points. The first is this is actually something we first saw foreshadowed in the Nevada caucus last week, where Hillary Clinton won 76% of the African-American vote. Yeah. That's what won her Nevada. In a state that we all think of as having this huge, you know, Latino population, it has a 13% African-American population. That put her over the top. In South Carolina, if she reinforces that narrative, then with all of these southern states, when we hit Super Tuesday on
March 1st.
You have
to say it. SEC primary, you have to say
it. I'm not saying it.
It's a rule.
I'm not.
You're a reporter, you have to say
it. In the ACC primary, coming up on the 15th now. Anyway, on Super Tuesday, if the trend continues, you're going to have a good number of delegates now in the hands of Hillary Clinton. So for Bernie Sanders' camp, it's tight. It's really tight to figure out how you can weave through if you cannot broaden your base to African-American voters. There's one other thing that's about to happen with the next two rounds of primaries, the Super Tuesday primary and March 15th when states like Florida, North Carolina,
Ohio.
Right. It happens to coincide with the single biggest springtime event of Bernie Sanders' biggest group of supporters. It's college spring break. As funny as that sounds, it may actually impact his voter turnout. If they don't put in their absentee ballots, he could look at a real powerful core of voters.
He's big in Pensacola. He's very big in Pensacola.
Yeah, exactly.
Plus, how much of this outcome now depends on the superdelegates, of which she has most of them, versus the ordinary
delegates. That is the real firewall for Hillary Clinton's campaign. But I don't think she's going to need them if she continues on this path. It could come.
Well, and remember, I heard someone point out this week that, you know, superdelegates were with Hillary in 2008, and then they
swapped.
They flipped to Obama. Yeah. So that I think that problem is overstated. I think the first problem you've outlined, that is why Bernie Sanders is teetering on the edge of collapse.
Yeah, I really think he's got to, you know, it's getting to the point where he behind the scenes, if not out, you know, in public, he needs to be thinking about how can I maximize my impact on the platform at the convention? I'm not going to be the nominee, but how can I maximize my impact? It's probably not what
Secretary
he really
of
wants
State
to be
if
thinking.
You fight hard enough, you know.
Yeah.
So, since phone banks, Dennis on Facebook wants to know, how do phone bank people know the race of the person they're calling?
It's a great question, and it actually varies on a couple of different things. Phone bank lists, I said in the report I was talking about earlier, it's not a bunch of people just randomly calling numbers out of the phone book. It's big data. I mean, it's big data at its best.
Because nobody can find the phone book anymore.
That's very true.
Really? But what is a phone book?
You take information from state voting records, you know, from registration, party affiliation, from past election participation. You then can break it down into areas based on, let's say, zip code, where you know certain parts of, let's say, Charlotte, where African American populations have higher concentration of the general population in certain zip codes. Mm-hmm. There are also things where they have proprietary information that they have gleaned from events, from canvassing when they knock on your door, from prior phone calls, from campaign websites. There's all kinds of different ways that you can meld this all together to get a better generalized sense of who you're about to call, and then you can use that to target to make sure that if you are weak in the African American community in this particular precinct, we're going to call them a whole bunch to try to sway that.
So they look at the old congressional districting maps in North Carolina to figure out who they're calling.
Nicely done.
It's not big data, Mike. That's a big headache.
Which Democrat do the Republicans want to see win ultimately this race for the nomination?
Well, if you look at the fact that one of the most famous or infamous, depending on your political point of view, Republican super PAC is now running ads that questions Hillary Clinton on issues like race relations and that kind of thing, I think it's fair to say that right now, since they're testing messages against Hillary, that they'd rather see Bernie. But you never know. I mean, let's not forget, again, I can't bring this up enough, nobody early on thought that John McCain would be the presidential nominee of the Republican Party in 2008. At different varying points in the 2012 campaign, Republicans expected it to be everyone from Rick Santorum to Herman Cain. So, it's hard to say right now who the Republicans think they're going to go against. I think they're just going to start testing against pretty much everybody.
So the South Carolina primary is tomorrow. The North Carolina primary is March 15th.
Ides of March.
So, yes, beware the Ides of
yes.
March. By that time, will everything have been decided? Do we matter?
Well, I think we'll probably still matter a smidge, which is better than we usually do. But Tuesday, the SEC primary, does seem to be the one that is going to convince us, most of us, I think, which way we're going. So, yeah, it is marginally something that matters.
So talk to me. We have, maybe after the break, because we have 45 seconds.
Mary's good at the last second.
That's right. Why do we take a back seat to South Carolina and Nevada and Iowa?
Timing.
But why? Yeah. Who made these decisions? When? Why? How? Why?
All in 40 seconds. Well, yeah, I'm done.
Think on that. You let that percolate in your brain, Eric with a K, and we'll come back and get an answer from you or somebody else when we come back from the break. Eric Spanberg is here from the Charlotte Business Journal, Eric Frazier from The Observer, Mary Newsom, UNC Charlotte Urban Institute, Tom Bullock from WFAE News. Send us your comments throughout the show on Facebook or Twitter at Charlotte Talks, or email us at charlottetalks at WFAE.org, and we are coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Honda of Concord, committed to customer service, satisfaction, and bringing excellence to the car buying experience, offering a selection of over 700 new and pre-owned vehicles. Details at hondaofconcord.com. Establishment Republicans grapple with how to stop Donald Trump. A political battle over the Supreme Court vacancy escalates, and the Senate reaches a bipartisan funding deal on the Flint water crisis. Those are just some of the stories they'll be talking about on the National News Roundup in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, the International Hour at 11, and our local hour continues. If you'd like to join the conversation, email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, search for WFAE on Facebook, or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
Vote early and vote often. No, this is not a call to corruption, but rather a plea to purchase votes at the bargain price of a buck a vote for me, WFAA General Manager Joe O'Connor, and Charlotte ballet dancer Raven Barkley in the Dancing with the Stars Gala on March 5th. Every dollar donated or ticket purchased in support of the O'Connor-Barkley team will be shared equally between the ballet and WFAE. To learn more, visit charlotteballet.org/gala. And thanks.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE, our local news roundup with WFAE's Tom Bullock, Mary Newsom from the Urban Institute, Eric Frazier from the Charlotte Observer, Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. I'm me. Now, Elon University has released a pre-North Carolina primary poll that kind of predicts the outcome. What does it reveal, Eric Spanberg?
Well,
are you going to call it the ACC primary?
What conference is Elon in? I don't even know. And I'm sorry to all Elon alums. The part that I looked at, actually, Mike, you asked me about the presidential part. The thing, Trump is winning, of course, and Hillary is ahead in the North Carolina Elon poll. The thing that caught my attention
was...
No, do I have that wrong?
Yes, Hillary is 47% to 41% over
No,
Trump.
He's talking about parties.
I was going parties.
Not head-to-head.
Yes. Right. Yes, and then Hillary would beat Trump, right?
Right.
Am
exactly.
I reciting that correctly?
Exactly, 47% to 41%
Yes.
I don't know what the margin of error on the poll is. So.
It's 2.5%
Okay. Looky there, nicely done. Rain Man. And so the other piece I was going to mention very quickly, though, is that, again, Roy Cooper and Pat McCrory are head-to-head. That was one of the things that stood out in the poll.
42 to 40
yes.
Roy Cooper.
Yes.
So that's within the margin of error.
Yes.
But when you combine the 42% for Cooper over McCrory with the 47% for Hillary over 41% for Trump, what does that say about North Carolina, which is viewed as being this red state?
No,
it says
get outside the cities.
No, it's not. I mean, it is.
Well, no, I think Mike's right. It is red outside the cities, but it's very blue in the cities.
Well, I would argue it is a very purple state. I mean, to go back to my earlier comparisons with 2008 and 2012, North Carolina voted for Barack Obama, and I think it was the margin of victory in 2008 was 0.3%.
Yeah, I don't like that.
And then in 2012, they voted for Mitt Romney by 2%.
Right.
I just want to throw a little cold water on this because it is really early. And
sure.
We cannot overestimate the fact that Super Tuesday primary is it really can be a game changer for one campaign or one candidate over another. And this poll, while this is a good quality poll, there's a huge thing that's about to happen that likely will directly affect which is a snapshot in time.
And I also think you have to remember historically that Harvey Gantt led all the polls over Jesse Helms.
Interesting. Let's say this. North Carolina was a much, much different state when – Harvey Gantt was running against Jesse Helms.
My point is that people don't always tell the truth.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That is an eternal verity. Yeah.
Or they don't go to the polls. Very well have some of that same dynamic going on, especially when it comes to Trump voters.
I don't want to say –
I don't want to say Trump, but I'm going to do it when I'm in the privacy of the voting booth.
Right. Or maybe they think they won't vote for him, but they get in there and they say, oh, maybe I will.
The Elon poll also asked this question about who should nominate the next – the successor to Antonin Scalia on the Supreme Court, and 57% of the people polled said President Obama should nominate a successor. 35% said that it should be left to the next president. So
I thought that was an interesting
number. If that's true, and you're right, they could say something other than what they really believe. But if that's true, what implications might that have on the Senate race in North Carolina?
That's a very good question, Mike. And you know, part of it is where does Burr ultimately – I mean, we know where Burr stands right now, but how does he handle the conversation as it goes on as we get to a nominee? In other words, would he even meet with a nominee? You know, we had this whole situation this week where Mitch McConnell and others were saying, look, we're not even opening the door. So this is something, if you're Senator Burr, you have to finesse and you have to keep those kinds of numbers in mind.
And you've already seen Tillis, who's not even on the ballot this year –
but he is on the Judiciary Committee.
Very carefully about one thing and then moving a little bit in the other direction.
Tillis had a very interesting statement. He said, we don't want to be seen as obstructionist. And then in the next breath, he said, by the way, to approve someone, he would have to be basically the twin of Antonin Scalia in terms of judicial process, which we know he will not be.
And not to sound too cynical, but I think most voters – don't really vote based on issues, complicated issues like that. They vote based on gut feelings.
That's what Donald Trump's counting on.
So before we move on, Andrew writes, why is it that we don't use open primaries? Isn't that a better system for getting the best candidate from both Democrats and Republicans? It seems to me having closed primaries just moves the nominees from parties further away from the middle. That, and here's, let me add a question. Why don't we just have a national primary?
Well, we do have a national primary.
It takes
place. No, it takes place on November, which is a general election. You really can't have a national primary. It's at that point, it's just a full-on election.
Well, what about open primaries?
It's a great question, and it's something philosophically, I think, if you're looking to find the best, most electable candidate from either party, that's the way you would do it. You would have a full-on open primary. Officially here in North Carolina, we have what's called a semi-closed primary, which basically means that you either have to be registered with one of the parties to vote in that party's primary, or you, if you're registered unaffiliated, you have to go and pick.
You can opt in.
You can opt in, basically.
To one.
To one, yeah, exactly. You know, the big reason as to why we don't do that is simple. You know, this may surprise some people, but the party primaries are set up and run by the parties.
Right.
And it's a big thing for them. I mean, it is an important part of what they do in a state. And there's always been arguments about, you know, a full-on open primary could lead to, you know,
chaos.
Mischievous voting and chaos and things. But
– well, the number of groups you would have to get to agree to retool the Electoral College, the primary system and all that, that's why we have a – state of stasis, because it would take so much that essentially we're left with the system we have.
So Charlotte City Council has approved the non-discrimination ordinance at their latest meeting, which outlaws discrimination against LGBTQ people. And Eric, in an editorial in The Observer, the paper suggested substituting the word black for gay as a way of gaining perspective on this issue. But a lot of black people take issue with that comparison.
Well, sure. I mean, it's a complex issue, and there's, you know, lots of room for different people to fall, you know, sort of one foot over here and another foot over there, you know, in terms of, you know, complicated, sort of nuanced positioning. But I think this is a situation where, you know, the city council, from my perspective, did the right thing. Because bias and discrimination is bias and discrimination at period. And everyone is supposed to have the same rights and the same opportunities in society. And whenever you single out one group and tell them you can't have the same government protected benefit or opportunity as everyone else, then that's wrong.
And the council passed this ordinance over the threat of having it overturned by the legislature. And now that it's been passed, both Governor McCrory and key members of the legislature have come out against it, and in fact, Tim Moore, who's the Speaker of the House, is considering a special legislative session to deal with this.
They, being the Republican Party in North Carolina, clearly sees this as a home run of an issue for them. They are singling out the bathroom provisions, which are the most controversial and perhaps the hardest for the average person to get their brain around.
But is it a home run long term when you consider the fact this is another example of the legislature inserting themselves into local politics?
But nobody thinks long term. I mean, people think next election. And so I think that's part of – the other thing I think will be very interesting that both of you are hitting on, I went to the sort of pregame show, if you will, on Monday in the rain, and – there were a lot of African-American – there were several African-American preachers and also white preachers as well. And both sides were hitting on – they were agreeing on LGBT as a bad ordinance. But they were both hitting on the civil rights issue over and over again, saying don't try to equate this with the bloodshed by African-Americans during the civil rights era. And that's a long way of me saying it'd be interesting to see kind of what the populist swell is once this makes it to the legislature.
Yeah. And I don't think the legislature even has to actually decide to convene or overturn it. They've accomplished part of their mission by just terrifying every city council and county commission in North Carolina by do anything we don't like and we will squash you like a bug.
And the other thing is, did you see all the Republican statements that were – questioning Roy Cooper and where he stands on this. Yeah, and, you know, so clearly it is all about November. Yeah. And so you can see the ads already being crafted, no doubt, on both sides.
Well, a number of articles have pointed out that Governor McCrory, who is against this and has said so, when he was Charlotte's longtime mayor, had never been a friend to LGBTQ cause. And he's up in a tough reelection campaign. Can he afford to alienate anybody, any potential voter?
Well, but Mike, remember, does that rally his base?
Right. I mean, that's he's got problems even in his base. So, he frankly, politically, needs this.
I don't think he's ever had the LGBT community in his camp anyway, so he's not losing them. They're gone.
Right. Republican Representative Dan Bishop from Mecklenburg County, who was on this program talking about this and talking about his opposition and why he feels this is the wrong thing to do, is at odds with Bob Hageman, who is Charlotte City Attorney, over the legality of the ordinance. They're both attorneys. How does Hageman defend it?
He says that there are 250 other cities that have similar ordinances in place, and none of those cities are lacking the ability to have a defined men's room and women's room in public places. What Dan Bishop is saying, in essence, is by passing this ordinance, what you're saying is you can't have any specification of a gender for a restroom. In other words, everybody just goes in every restroom. And so the city manager just says it has no basis. And I assume that where all this is eventually going to wind up is in a courtroom with lawyers arguing these things.
Or at the special session with the legislature. One other point that's really interesting is Dan Bishop brings up another legal argument, which is that the city of Charlotte, we are, of course, you've heard us say this before, a Dillon Rule state, which means that all local municipal power is only there because the legislature said that they could do something with it. And he brought up Dan Bishop brought up the fact that the only clearance in his view that the city has to change non-discrimination ordinances deals with housing along the lines of what federal law encourages or requires. This actually deals with commercial businesses, with things like restaurants, with things like you know taxi cabs and Uber. So it is a very subtle difference that I if it does make it to a courtroom, I'm going to be fascinated to hear.
And Dan Bishop has said after it was passed, he said that this is even worse than I have outlined previously. It outlaws sex-specific facilities completely. Is that true? Is it substantially different from what they looked at and rejected a couple of months ago?
Well, again, this is in the eye of the beholder. I mean, Bob Hageman, who is the city attorney, says absolutely not. This ordinance stands just fine next to the other ones that have been passed across around the country, and we still have men's and women's rooms. And Dan Bishop swears up and down that that is not the case. They're both lawyers, and so, you know, until somebody renders a verdict, you have to kind of pick your side.
But Bob Hageman does have a long history of expertise in municipal law. I don't know what Dan Bishop's legal expertise is, but if Bob Hageman has researched it and says, here's what all the precedent is, I tend to believe that he has, in fact, done that.
So city council rejected this the first time around. What made them switch? Was there any change in the
– Well, I think one thing is that Michael Barnes is no longer on the council. Yeah. Michael Barnes was the mayor pro tem at the time, and he opposed it. And remember the last time – by the way, last time we had singing, which I thought was much more entertaining than this last round of citizen testimony, but the last time they went to a compromise where the bathroom issue was taken off the table, and two Democrats said, "I'm not voting for a watered down version."
Yeah, Luana Mayfield and Autry, and you know, it was a principled stand that they took, and they said, "If transgender can't come under the tent with everyone else, then we're not voting for anything."
So, lightning round now, because I got to get to CMS before we end this program today. And the school board has finally given us an idea of what they're thinking on pupil assignment. They voted 7-1 this week for assignment goals. And what are the goals?
Well, it's they've.
I got it. Provide choice, reduce concentrations
you
of poverty.
Got it. Right there in front of you.
Ease concentrations of poverty, ease overcrowding, protect successful schools. Are these significantly different from the earlier goals they drafted
not
last
significant.
Month?
Not
significant. No, and notice one thing, not what they voted on, but what they didn't include, which is a guaranteed right to a homeschool slot for all students. That actually was voted down.
And why? Because everybody likes that.
Well, they kept saying that they wanted this to be aspirational, which was the word that kept getting, you know, and that would be narrowing the focus too much. And I think a lot of the neighborhood school folks in the audience saw that as kind of a cop out, and you really just don't want to give us the guarantee that we're here demanding. But The school board kept saying, the leaders of the school board kept saying that they are going to address that at the next stage of the process.
Boy, have we heard that somewhere before?
Do they have any clue about how they could carry out any of these goals at all yet?
Well, what they're going to do next is they're hiring a basically an expert consultant who will come in and try to actually put some flesh and bones on this, or some meat on this, the bones that they've put forward.
Meanwhile, Matthews Mayor Jim Taylor has said concerns about CMS busing have pushed him to explore a separate suburban school district. We have heard this before. Was this a complete surprise that it's happening in Matthews?
No surprise, but I think it's more of a negotiating ploy than anything.
And he admits he's not sure how practical this would be.
Yeah, it's too hard.
Oh, that's okay. Look at the city of Ballantyne, Mike.
We'll figure it out. Yeah,
but I think the problem is anytime you raise the specter, it's like you've dropped a bomb
into
the room.
Right.
Now, in a way, the exodus has already begun, because in a small way, to charter schools, because this week the Observer education reporter Andos Helms revealed that while Mecklenburg County Public School enrollment expects to grow by roughly 3,200 students next year, not for every one that chooses a CMS school, five will choose charter schools. Yeah. That's an amazing difference.
It's an eye-opening fact. And I think that is, more than anything else, that is the fact, the elephant in the room, that's going to sort of restrain the school board in terms of moving really aggressively back towards anything remotely resembling 1970s style.
Is that sustainable growth on either side of that equation?
Potentially for charter schools, yes. Not for CMS, because eventually 500, that's not that much when you consider how fast the city and the metropolitan area is growing. It's going to hurt their school construction and everything else.
Tom Bullock gets the last word from WSAU News, as it should be. Mary Newsom, Associate Director of the UNC Charlotte Urban Institute, Eric Spanberg, Senior Writer for the Charlotte Business Journal, and Eric Frazier, Editorial Writer for the Charlotte Observer, who just won a North Carolina Press Association Award for Editorial Writing.
Thank you for the plug.